very good afternoon to you, Namibia and the world. And thank you for tuning in to Eagle FM. I am Ndafa Happy Juju, and you're listening to On The Radar, your trusted source for informed updates, critical insights, and unpacked developments from across Namibia's economic, social, and governance landscape. Now, this isn't just about headlines. OTR, also known shortly for On The Radar, is a space for deep, meaningful engagement where we interrogate the stories shaping our country. We ask the hard questions, revisit past coverage, and connect the dots using archived audio, expert opinion, and sharp analysis. From major policy decisions to grassroots realities, we bring you the full picture. On today's program, we'll take you through three key developments that matter. We hear from expert Mekonjo Erastus on how Namibia's investment landscape can better align with Vision 2030's green goals. Next, we unpack the need for integrating environmental sustainability into business transactions and what it means for Namibia's long-term development goals. Later on, we dive into Namibia's new event-based surveillance guidelines and how they are set to transform the country's health emergency response system. Our interviews are long form and in-depth because some stories deserve more than a sound bite. We come prepared with the facts, the context, and your questions so that every conversation takes us closer to understanding what truly lies beneath. Now remember, On The Radar is available live across Eagle FM's national radio frequencies, live streaming through Eagle FM website, and you can also subscribe to our WhatsApp channel for real-time updates. Don't forget also the Eagle FM app that you can download via your mobile phone. Now, interview highlights and exclusive clips are what you can expect on The Radar. So stay with us and stay beyond the surface. This is On The Radar, where Namibia comes to think. And for now, the news. Namibia is making strides towards its Vision 2030 by urging financial and transactional advisors to focus more on environmental and social priorities in every deal they handle. Mekonjo Erastus, Head of Research for Monasa Advisory and Associates, tells us why embedding environmental, social and governance, or known as ESG, criteria throughout the entire deal process is so important. It's not just about profits anymore. It's about ensuring business supports sustainable development and social equity as well. With Namibia aiming for a green and inclusive economy, this approach could attract investors who care about transparency and long-term impact. Now, to get a clearer picture of what this means for Namibia's economic future, I spoke with Mekonjo Erastus, and let's now take time to listen to what he had to say. Good afternoon, Mekonjo Erastus.
Good afternoon, Happy. How are you?
I'm all good. Welcome to On The Radar News Bulletin.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Now, Mekonjo, you wrote an article on inclusive transactional advisory where you suggest that transactional advisory must go beyond financial metrics. Now, what prompted your push for a more inclusive approach to deal-making in Namibia?
So, as a Namibian consulting firm, obviously very familiar with our unique socioeconomic context. And under observation and through our work, we understand obviously there's been economic growth. But Namibia continues to face sort of deep-rooted inequalities, a dual economy of formal and informal sectors, and sort of a persistent exclusion of you know, rural communities that are stuck in a cycle of perpetual poverty. So when we're looking at traditional deal making focused solely on financial metrics, it often fails to address these disparities and, you know, in some cases inadvertently enforce them. So we just basically, you know, want to ensure that deals are designed at their core to deliver on some sort of social value and also have that, that impact, for the broader population.
Now, you also mentioned that the term sustainability can reinforce power structures and inequalities in Africa. Could you expand on that and explain why inclusivity is a more appropriate guiding principle?
Yes, so at Monasa, yes, we've kind of moved away from using the term sustainable. It implies basically a continuation of the status quo, where the powers that be basically, you know, continue, you know, maintaining the current structure whilst only making incremental changes, sort of a superficial adherence to sort of compliance. Our approach basically demands that all stakeholders, especially, you know, groups that have been, you know, initially marginalized, are meaningfully involved in decision making and benefit sharing. It provides sort of, you know, opportunity creation as well. If you just look at basically our statistics in this country being, you know, one of, if not this, basically the second most unequal society in the world, with, you know, double digit unemployment figures, any value created will be eroded down the line if these issues aren't addressed immediately, either through social unrest, which could threaten the stability that we've built our economy on. So, yeah, that was basically our approach to basically changing the dynamic from sustainability to inclusive.
Mm-hmm. Now, what changes or reforms, Mekonjo, would you like to see in Namibia's advisory, legal and regulatory sectors to better support inclusive transactions?
Well, there needs to be mandatory inclusivity and then sort of an ESG criteria, a Namibian ESG criteria developed. Currently, I know certain financial institutions have taken a proactive approach creating ESG frameworks, but there's no real overarching, you know, framework for all sectors to follow in terms of ESG. Obviously, you know, Namibia being a net carbon sink, which means that we actually, you know, absorb more carbon than we produce. We basically have the right as a sovereign nation to determine what ESG means for Namibians. So these sort of clear benchmarks and community benefits as well as local participation needs to be enshrined through community benefits agreements across all deals and investments that come into country. It also needs to be sort of transparent reporting and accountability mm-hmm. that comes with that. There needs to be some sort of legal incentives that can really strengthen and enforce local content across all sectors mm-hmm. and ownership requirements. We think that employee share ownership scheme should be sort of, you know, brought in across the board. That also, you know, but local content will also now promote SME participation. But also, yeah, capacity building needs to be developed as well, so that these communities, when they enter into these community benefits, you know, agreements, they are organized and they have capacity to basically understand, you know, what value they can actually, you know, extract from any agreement or any investment that comes into the country. And these need to be formalized. Yeah, so that's just basically some of the regulatory forms that can be instituted that can help.
Mm-hmm. And are communities or community members also consulted in terms of when projects are actually being ticked on to see that they can go ahead and execute whatever it is that they are going to do? Are communities also then consulted? And when they are consulted, if they are their advices actually taken into consideration to say, okay, but the community says that this might not actually align?
Historically, there haven't been meaningful consultation with local communities, to be fair, or local mm-hmm. stakeholders. There's always a power imbalance between, you know, large institutions and local communities when it comes to stakeholder engagement. And usually these stakeholder engagements happen after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
So these need to be basically institutionalized. There needs to be institutionalized meaningful consultation and participation of affected communities in all stages of deal making.
Yeah. Now, how can Namibia ensure that inclusivity becomes more than just a policy commitment on paper and is embedded into the structure and execution of every major deal going forward?
Well, yeah, that's basically where, you know, as Namibians, you know, we have that patriotic duty to make sure that, you know, every deal has the best interest of everyone involved. I mean, there's still some capacity gaps. Obviously, that's why, you know, some of these deals are really one-sided. But there needs to be an overarching framework from ESG perspective You know, more of a, depends now if it's a carrot or stick approach, but there needs to be basically a directive that, really sort of integrates social ethics and sustainable committees across sort of corporates and standardized tools, basically, and also obviously ongoing training that needs to be, you know, instituted. But yeah, these are some of the issues that we have currently in country. But for Namibians to really, you know, understand that, you know, we need to provide broader access, broader wealth opportunity for the rest of the population. It's imperative that we, as you know, transactional advisors as well as, you know, corporates and financiers locally, you know, step up to the plate.
Yeah. Now, Mekunju, lastly, before I actually close off our interview, who actually is accountable when, for instance, assessments are made? You know, though perhaps they revealed that particular investment or particular project cannot go ahead, and it does go ahead, and maybe those who are actually ticking the box tick all the right boxes, even though this is not right for the environment. Who then is held accountable, and what guidelines are in place to ensure that these people are held accountable for that?
That's a tough question. I mean, our current sort of legal environment basically will hold them accountable once a law in its sort of, you know, base form is broken, in terms of environmental, I guess, non-compliance or, you know, some level of exploitation that goes beyond what was agreed upon. But other than that, you know, I mean, there's not real a lot of sort of mechanisms to hold, you know, some of these large institutions accountable for basically, you know, not abiding to their, you know, initial promises or arrangements that they've made. So yeah, there's not really a framework in place beyond, you know, the normal legal routes that can hold these institutions accountable.
Mm-hmm. And also, I spoke to an environmentalist consultant, and he said that environmentalists or those that deal with this stuff don't actually have a governing body, sort of to say, like, for instance, how doctors and nurses have the Health Professions Council, and also engineers have the engineer professionals. There's not really a regulatory body that then holds them accountable. Is that true? And why not so? Although maybe you're not the right person to actually answer that question.
I might not be the right person in terms of environmentalists, but there should be. Yeah, I mean, there should be a regulatory body that basically, you know, oversees basically the conduct of the, I guess, their EIAs and their environmental assessments that they provide to, you know, companies looking to exploit our resources, for instance, just as an example, mm-hmm. In country. So yeah, I mean, that would be concerning if that's not in place. But yeah, I mean, it's something that, you know, if you look at Vision 2030 and sort of the goals that we've set out, which are very ambitious, we're looking at basically, 2.3% unemployment by 2030, which is very far off track at the moment. If we look at sort of the GDP growth of 6% annually, we need to balance basically, you know, our commitment to environmental protection to economic development as well. There are people who, you know, are destitute and there's no opportunities for them to earn a living. But at the same time, you know, we have large swaths of land which are being protected, you know, rightfully so. But at the same time, there needs to be a balance struck, especially with Namibia being a net carbon sink. And our net sort of contribution to carbon emissions is negligible. We need to decide for ourselves basically what environmental protection means for us and, you know, where the trade-off is with, you know, creating meaningful employment opportunities and economic opportunities beyond just, you know, promising the odd job or so from a large investor who's coming into the country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get that. Mekunju, thank you so much for making time for us right here on the Reader News Bulletin.
Thank you, Abby. Really appreciate it.
Okay.
All right.
Mm-hmm. Building on that, I also spoke to environmentalist John Pallett about whether Namibia's business deals truly consider long-term environmental impacts, where he shared insights on essential environmental safeguards, risks for resource projects, and the role of impact assessment in protecting our natural resources. Let's now hear what John Pallett has to say about aligning investments with Namibia's Vision 2030.
Good afternoon, John Pallett, and welcome to On the Reading News Bulletin.
Yes, good afternoon, Happy. Yep. Nice to speak to you.
Now, an article by Mekonjo Erastus speaks about transactional advisory. Now, from environment perspective or an environmentalist perspective, do you think current business transactions in Namibia adequately consider long-term environmental impacts?
This is a difficult one. My immediate answer is no.
Mm-hmm.
Not enough. And let me explain how I get there. You know, environment is such an important feature for all of us. And we have national commitments. We have, commitments that the Ministry of Environment has signed us up to internationally, like the UN Convention on Biodiversity and on climate change and on combating desertification and all of these things. And we all know that we have to look after the environment that we live in.
Mm-hmm.
We need birds, trees, animals around us. They are all part of an ecosystem which actually supports human life. But economics does not recognize that reality. I'm not just talking about Namibian economics and businesses and deals and so on. I'm just talking about the international system of money that we all work in doesn't adequately recognize the value of environment and put a price on environmental damage when it occurs. So I kind of worry that things that must attract investors are all very good, and we do want investment in this country. We want the right kind of development. We want people to get employed and prosperity to continue rising. Well, it isn't rising at well. We want prosperity for our people, but we also need to look after our environment, and we have to consider the costs that big developments have on the environment. So we can't just willy-nilly forge ahead with a whole lot of unsustainable stuff, which is actually going to backfire on us if we start damaging water sources and biodiversity and so on.
Yeah.
So that's my kind of overarching principle to all of this.
Now, Pallett, the article argues for integrating environmental, social, and governance principles in all phases of deal-making. Now, what environmental criteria do you believe should be non-negotiable in any major transaction?
Goodness. Any development, any major development, any significant development like the opening of a mine or trying to build new roads to enhance infrastructure or so on, all of those things require an environmental impact assessment, and that's part of the Environmental Management Act, which has been in force for more than 10 years. And so all of that is a necessity, and important principles in the Environmental Management Act are that you are not allowed to degrade any natural resources in a way that's going to make them unrecoverable. You've got to have certain amounts of, so that's an environmental consideration. You've got to go through a certain amount of public consultation to actually hear what the public thinks of the development, and people are allowed to raise their concerns. So that's a social and a governance consideration. So those are essential parts of an EIA. But the Environmental Management Act is very poorly implemented in this country and very poorly complied with. So there are many EIAs which simply do not adequately cover those aspects, and they get away with it. The review process by the Ministry of Environment is not very thorough. So those things are vitally important, but often they get ignored or done rather poorly, and the environmental clearance certificate gets issued anyway, and the development goes ahead with a whole lot of damage occurring to the environment. And we have a clear example of that when we had that whole recon fiasco a few years ago, when there was a Canadian company coming into the country and saying they're going to drill for oil, and they supposedly did an EIA. But the EIA was so poorly done. It did not have enough public consultation. It did not consider contamination of water resources. They didn't line their tailings dams. So there were a whole lot of very serious flaws in that environmental impact assessment. But the clearance was given, and we all know that RECON has gone ahead, and they are still busy drilling up there in Kavango. So that's an example of something, an extreme example of a very poor EIA, where the public has been misled about what is actually going to happen with that development. Yet the ministry doesn't do anything about it. It's worrying and it's disappointing.
And inclusivity is also one thing, especially for those from people in the community where perhaps a project is going to be carried out. This is where I think inclusivity comes in, to say, let's hear from those in the community. And usually, of course, they may not have the degrees or the correct information or the taming to use, but they sometimes often know very well what is not good for their community. Would you say the government should incorporate in order to listen to those people as well?
Well, there are principles in the Act which the environmental practitioner is supposed to comply with. So the consultation, which is a mandatory part of an EIA, has got to be suited to the people who it's addressing. So it's got to be put out there in a way which people can understand, and that they can attend the meetings, and that they are given adequate opportunity. The environmental practitioner has got to make sure that they do actually contact all the relevant stakeholders. You know, it's very easy to kind of do those aspects of the work in a shoddy fashion, and then show that box has been ticked. But of course, the local communities on the ground know if they've been consulted or not, and we've subsequently heard a lot from those people up in Kavango that the person whose land was actually going to be used for the drilling, those people just rocked up and started there and started with all of their drilling equipment. He had not been consulted at all. And that just shows that the public consultation was not done properly, no matter how much the practitioner says he did everything he could. It was not adequate. That's the bottom line.
So what improvements would you like to see, or for all of us to see, John, in government departments or laws to better protect the environment when deals are being made? I mean, yesterday, the Namibian delegation is in Luanda, or was in Luanda, Angola, advocating for investors to come and invest in Namibia. But then are policies like this actually being implemented? And what can be done to ensure that they are implemented?
Yeah. You know, those kind of investment policies are great. I welcome those kind of initiatives where Namibia is putting itself out there and saying, yes, we are a great country for investment, and let's welcome developments which are going to help us. But as I say, they do have to be done properly. So, So the Environmental Management Act is an important part of that, but there's no professional body of environmental practitioners which is recognized. There are many environmental practitioners in the country and many new graduates coming out of degrees at NUST and UNAM find EIAs as an easy way of making money, and that's good that they are coming into the sector. But you do need a certain amount of experience, and you do need a certain amount of kind of background skills. You've got to know what is this development likely to entail? Is it going to have any impact on water resources? Is it going to cause air pollution? Mm-hmm. What sort of local consultations must be done? All of those things require a lot of expertise and experience. Now, there is a professional body. It's called the Environmental Assessment Practitioners Association of Namibia, EPAN. Mm-hmm. But that is not recognized by government, and it's totally a voluntary organization. So people who want to do EIAs properly are in there trying to support the right kind of standards in EIAs. But people who simply don't want to be there can just ignore it, and there's nothing to stop any person from starting a business doing EIAs with no experience whatsoever. So we need some sort of professional affiliation.
Yeah, such as
which would require people to have that expertise and to show that they are doing proper thorough EIAs.
And one that can actually hold them accountable.
And hold them accountable so that if they are not doing proper EIAs, they can be struck off the roll and they won't be allowed to in future.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that really is important. But the ministry doesn't want to help establish that professional organization that's been suggested to the Environmental Commissioner for more than 10 years now that is a necessary part of the sector since we've got this act now. But they are just dragging their heels. Somehow there are objections to to getting that thing established.
I see.
But you think of other professions like engineering and architects and doctors and stuff. They've all got their professional associations to maintain the standards in that sector, and that's a necessary part of the sector. So the environment is no different.
Exactly. So I don't get why there actually isn't one, but I think
Anyway, so but just to get back to that article, that op-ed about
inclusive transactionary advice,
inclusivity, and he talks about ESG, environmental, social, and governance aspects. I mean, those are really important, and I fully agree with the op-ed. We do have to include those in our investment invitations, that people have got to realize that, yes, they are welcome to come and make investments here, but there are ESG standards which we want to uphold. And this will actually help all of society. It won't just it will make sure that the benefits are long-lasting, they don't have nasty environmental impacts down the line. It will ensure that the right kind of social aspects are considered, that there's training, that there's work made available, that people are consulted in the development process, and that there's the right governance in place, that we don't see corrupt deals happening. So all of those things, those three aspects, environment and social and governance, ESG, are really critical, and I support the op-ed fully.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah. Interesting. John Pallett, thank you so much for making time for us right here on the Radar News Bulletin.
No, I'm saying that's a great pleasure. Just to let people know where I come from, I'm speaking on behalf of the Namibian Environment and Wildlife Society in EWS. We take an interest in EIAs, and I'm also an environmental assessment practitioner myself, so I do have some experience in this regard. But thanks for the opportunity.
Okay, John.
Good. Thank you.
And there you had it. Now I've tried to get hold of the Ministry of Environment and Forestry, but unfortunately the commissioner has been engaged. Although he's willing to speak, he's been so engaged with other commitments. But I should have his voice at least by tomorrow, and if possible, perhaps later today before we actually do close off On the Radar News Bulletin. But nonetheless, you are tuned into On the Radar News Bulletin, where we take what's happening and we interrogate it to try and break down and ask the questions, the whys, the how, the when, and the what, so that we can actually understand the story and hear more than just what is being laid out on the surface. Now, with that being said, we also invite you to partake in the news bulletin right here on the radar. Our studio line is very much open for you as well. The number in studio is 083-288-401. So you're more than welcome to also share your opinions and contributions. So perhaps also ask questions, or perhaps questions that you want us to ask relevant bodies that could also answer to that which is being brought up on the table. Now that's the number in studio. I repeat it, 083-288-401. To make sure that you head over to our Eagle FM website to ensure that you don't miss out on any news that is happening right here on the radar. You can alternatively also download the Eagle FM app in your mobile phone so that you can listen to us wherever and whenever you are. Now let's pause here, take a trip to the marketplace, but we'll surely be back right now, not after so many minutes, and we'll get into other news stories.
Lipura nengeno wapumbwa eva tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nuku dite okoye ekukurile oshafa fana nongeshe faili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshiwana onongeshe fa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi toda njuka okukwetira oipindi konu konda doi nawa nune udo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshe fa omarudi dayo loka opone ushendife nawa nokumona oijabo ili nawa Ninge kwa tafanona, Monica ko Eagle FM, onore tatuimwe bali heari, nola natu, heari bali no heari. Ile ko derewa, nora hetatu natu, bali o hetatu watatu, o mafilane, Eagle FM, the eye.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of failure.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who does not have a capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Welcome back. Now it's Wednesday, and of course, the 25th of June, 2025, and our edition for Wednesday, that is the Villager e-paper, is now available. Make sure that you grab your copy and read the best economic news and more. Now, today's e-paper covers the following headlines. Package threatens spill charge recovery. Aquaculture farmer achieves harvest of 4,500. 4,500 fish. 2025 Global African Hydrogen Summit Ball gets rolling, and it's set to take place very, very soon this very year of 2025. And I sure hope that you're getting your cards ready to make your way to the African Hydrogen Summit that's going to be held right here in Namibia. Netball professionalization pilot project enters the final leg. Nedbank concludes funding deal with Trollop contractors. Will millennials in Namibia retire comfortably? That's an opinion piece right in our The Villager e-paper. Now make sure that you still stay informed by subscribing to the Eagle Media WhatsApp channel and receive a tri-weekly dose of economic, social and community news absolutely free of charge. That is news every Monday, Wednesday and Friday. All you have to do is send a text message to 081-200-4144 and you never have to miss an update. The Ministry of Health has officially launched new national guidelines for event-based surveillance, a system designed to strengthen Namibia's ability to detect and respond to public health threats more rapidly. Now, unlike traditional surveillance methods that rely mainly on laboratory results and clinical reports, event-based surveillance collects information from a wide range of sources, including community reports, social media, and other informal channels, that is to help identify outbreaks or health emergencies early. Now, with Namibia continuing to face public health challenges such as cholera outbreaks and the lingering impact of COVID-19, the introduction of this system is seen as a critical step in improving the country's preparedness and response. Now, to explain how the new system will work and what it actually entails and what it means for Namibia, we spoke to Walter Skamaya, who is a public relations officer from the Ministry of Health and Social Services. Let's take a listen as I ask the questions.
Good afternoon, Mr. Walter Skamaya, and welcome to On the Reading News Bulletin.
Good afternoon to you too, and good afternoon to our listeners.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand that the Ministry of Health and Social Services on Monday launched an event-based surveillance, also known as EBS. Now, what exactly is event-based surveillance and how does it differ from the traditional surveillance systems Namibia has been using?
Thank you very much. The Minister of Health and Social Services launched what we call event-based surveillance technical guideline for Namibia. It's different because if we are to look, things are changing every day. The technology is changing, the diseases that are emerging are different, the calamities, the communicable diseases that are different. So as a ministry, we have to develop and keep up to the new technology. And then that also, there are a lot of factors that are driving the increasing burden of diseases, which are multi-faced. The ministry also has seen it fit that we should develop a new guideline in terms of how do we respond, how do we react to the new emerging diseases that are coming.
Mm-hmm. Now, why was now the right time to launch those guidelines, and what specific public health challenges are they designed to address?
Yes, if you look now, the country or the community have gone through different diseases. We can speak of the one that's ended or not fully ended, COVID-19. It has taught us some lessons. Mm-hmm. In the context of Namibia now, we are talking of cholera, which has just been declared in Obuo. And then we are talking that many 10 regions of Namibia were hard hit by malaria. And then we talk of other these influenzas and other things. So for the ministry to be able to react to those emergencies effectively or to have an effective response, we need to develop the guidelines, the standard operation guidelines.
Yeah. Now, Namibia has faced several public health challenges in recent years, as you have just spoken about now. Now, how will the EBS system improve the country's ability to respond to future outbreaks or emergencies? I know we just recently also detected cholera in one household. So how exactly do we intend to attend or respond to future outbreaks?
All right, they just launched guidelines. They have got 5 steps that will be able to help us to react or to respond very well. And then those 5 steps there are guidelines we are launching, or we launched on Monday.
Mm-hmm.
They've got five essential steps. One of them is, step number one is the detection
mm-hmm.
of diseases. It is important that first and foremost, when there is an emergency, it should be a provision of detecting it. And then the triage, the verification, it should be verified, that it should be confirmed, it should be verified. And then there is the risk assessment of it. Are you able to do the risk assessment of that particular emergence that has just emerged? And then above all is to find or to give the action and response. So
yeah.
If you are able to do these things, you should be able to respond effectively to the emergence. So these are new guidelines that should be able to inform us. When we talk about malaria, are we able to diagnose it? Are we able to screen people? Are we able to tell people you are positive? Are we able to give proper results?
Mm.
Are we able to treat them? When we talk of cholera, do we have the capacity to detect it?
Mm.
Do we have the capacity to screen? Do we have the capacity to tell that this is cholera outbreak? All those things are needed.
Yeah. Now, often the Ministry of Health, or in the health profession setting, there's usually guidelines that are supposed to be followed in terms of what and what not. But along the way, some of those guidelines get toasted on the other side and are not followed thoroughly. So what measures are in place to ensure that those guidelines are going to be thoroughly followed, and that the results are actually used in order to protect the wider Namibia?
What we want to say is that nursing is a career. It's a profession. Before you get there, you have to take the oath. You have to be oriented. So driving away from the standard operating procedures, that's something else that calls for action of accountability, and there are consequences to do that. And those consequences, they can lead to the loss of life. So what we do is that we encourage and motivate our people to stick to the standard operating guidelines for them to be able to be effective. So doing it otherwise, it's not our wish. It's not our intention. But what we tell people is that for us to be able to be victorious, or to be able to make an impact, or for us to be able to treat our people, we need to stick to them.
Mm. Now, are there specific tools or platforms, perhaps digitally or community-based, that will be used to report and tackle potential health threats under the new system?
There are people on the ground. The ministry have deployed a number of people in different parts of the country, whereby to go and give public health education. And then there are health community workers that are working with the community on a daily basis. We have got our radio stations, we have our facilities, we have our clinics, health centers, and then we have gone on a relentless campaign of engaging with the people, that immediately when they see such, even people when they start experiencing the symptoms, we have advised them to visit the facilities for diagnosis and treatment, or for screening purposes. So by now, I want to believe that our people know that when there is a need, where should they go? And then when they get there, how should they present themselves? So this we are giving through platforms such as this, now that we have a radio talk with you. This mm-hmm. is a message going to them that how can they report this? Also, the ministry issued a press release where this information was articulated at length.
Hmm. Now, will Namibia be collaborating with other countries or regional bodies to share data and respond collectively to cross-border health threats?
Yes, Namibia is not operating in isolation. It's operating in collaboration with others. We have got UNICEF on board, we have WHO, we have Red Cross. So the collaboration is already there. Whatever we do, we seek guidance from WHO,
mm-hmm.
World Health Organization.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that Namibia is operating in silos or in isolation,
mm-hmm.
but we are working together with stakeholders to be able to be victorious over the emerging emergencies.
Mm-hmm. And I see that the Namibia Public Health Institute is also a key partner in future surveillance efforts. What role will they play, and how soon will it be fully operational?
The role that stakeholders play is to strengthen the response activities. That's the primary role.
Mm-hmm.
It's just to strengthen the health system, to team up together, to bring expertise together, so that at the end of the day, for the benefit of a Namibian citizen, we are able to respond to the emergencies successfully.
Mm-hmm. And what role is expected from us as citizens to ensure that the EBS is successful as well?
The role of the citizen is to stick to the message and to take heed of the message that the health professionals are doing. When the cholera, for example, was announced as an outbreak, the ministry gave the preventive measures such as hygiene,
mm-hmm.
whereby we gave the preventive measures on how to prevent cholera. So what we are telling the public is that their health should matter, and then their health should start with them.
Mm. Mr. Walter Skamanya, thank you so much for educating us on what EBS actually is all about.
It was a pleasure having me. Bye-bye.
Okay.
And now we pause here, take a trip to the marketplace, but before you know it, we are back and we'll bring you what's making headlines today in regards to trading economics or economic indicators. Stay tuned right here on the Radar News Bulletin. Remember, our studio line is still open for you to come through and partake in the News Bulletin. 0832-888-401 is the number in studio.
Get social with us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Our handle is Eagle FM Namibia.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Lipura nengeno wapumbwa eva tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida. Ashike kapeno nweko dite opoye ekukurile. Oshafafa na nongeshe faili mehola mo. Iho etike kovano ile koshiwana. Onongeshe faa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna emito danjuka okukwetira oipindi konu konda doi nawa nune udo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngejefa omarude kayo loka opone ushendife nawa nokumona oijamoiri nawa ninge kwata fanona monika ko Eagle FM onora etatu imwe mbali heari nola natu heari bali no heari ile konderewa mbara etatu natu bali o etatu batatu oma filane Eagle FM the eye.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of failure.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
So not a fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who does not have a capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Welcome back. And we're starting off locally, that is the Namibian dollar compared to other dollars or other currencies. Now, we're starting off with one USD will get you 17 Namibian dollars and 71 cents today, while one euro will get you 20 Namibian dollars and 56 cents. And £1 sterling will get you 24 Namibian dollars and 11 cents. While one Japanese yen will give you 0.12 Namibian dollars. One Chinese yuan equals to two Namibian dollars and 47 cents. While the Australian dollar will give you 11 Namibian dollars and 51 cents. One Swiss franc will give you 21 Namibian dollars and 97 cents. Now for other economic indicators. Iron ore futures fell to around 700 per ton on Wednesday, declining for a second consecutive session as supply pressures mounted and seasonal demand from China weakened. Shipments to China from top exporters Australia and Brazil surged to 30.1 million tons last week, the highest weekly volume this year, according to industry data. Now, adding to supply side pressure, Rio Tinto, the world's largest iron ore producer, secured final government approvals for its Hope Down 2 project, a joint venture with Hancock Prospecting. Now, the Spanish economy grew by 0.6% quarter on quarter in the first 3 months of 2025, matching the preliminary estimate, but slightly below the 0.7% expansion recorded in the previous quarter. Domestic demand contributed 0.5% points to growth, while external demand added 0.1 points. On the expenditure side, household consumption increased by 0.6% and gross fixed capital formation rose by 0.9%. Exports, on the other hand, grew by 1.7% and imports increased by 1.6%, while government consumption shrank 0.4%. The Shanghai Composite in China rose 1.04%, close to 3,456 on Wednesday, while the Shenzhen component surged 1.72% to 10,394, marking a third consecutive session of gains as fresh policy measures from Beijing boosted sentiment. Now, authorities unveiled draft guidelines aimed at bolstering consumption and supporting the broader economy. The proposal includes support for eligible consumer sector firms to raise funds through IPOs, bonds, and other channels. Financial institutions will also urge to enhance service delivery, innovate credit products, and strengthen risk management to better meet diverse consumer financing needs. Now, geopolitical sentiments improved as well, with the U.S. brokered ceasefire between Iran and Israel appearing to hold despite minor flare-ups. Adding to the positive tone, Trump has reportedly allowed China to continue purchasing oil from Iran, easing energy-related concerns. Notable gainers included East Money at plus 10%, Hithink Loyal Flush at plus 14.5%. Meanwhile, the Bank of Thailand kept its benchmark interest rate unchanged at 1.75% during its June 2025 policy meeting, as widely expected. Now, the Monetary Policy Committee voted 6-1 in favor of maintaining the current rate, which remains at its lowest level since April 2023. Headline inflation is projected to stay at just 0.5% in 2025 and 0.8% in 2026, while core inflation is also expected to remain low at 1% for 2025 and 0.9% in 2026. Consumer prices in Thailand fell by 0.57% in May 2025, marking the second consecutive month of deflation. Meanwhile, the Thai economy is forecasted to grow by 2.3% in 2025 and 1.7% in 2026. The economy expanded by 3.1% year on year in the first quarter of 2025, exceeding expectations of 2.9%, but eased from a revised 3.3% growth in the previous quarter. Now, the committee noted that the economic outlook remains highly uncertain, but reaffirmed its readiness to adjust monetary policy as needed in response to evolving economic conditions, risks, and inflation dynamics. Let's now pause right here and take a trip to the marketplace. And of course, you know, at this juncture, after when we do return from the marketplace, I'll bring you news beyond the borders. Of course, we'll start off regionally, move over to continental news, and then after, you can expect some international news. Now, our studio number has not been closed. The studio line is still very much open for you to come through and share your contributions or perhaps ask questions right here on the Radar News Bulletin. The number in studio is 083-288-401.
Lipura nengeno wapumbwa eva tere uliko ni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nweko tete opoye ekukurile. Oshafafa na nongeshefa ili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshuana. Onongeshefa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evito da njuka. Okukwetira oipindi konu konda doi nawa. Nune udo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshefa omarudi kayo loka. Opone ushendi fenawa nokumona oijamo ili nawa. Ninge fata fanona Monica ko Eagle FM onore tatuimwe mbali heali nola natu. Heali bali no heali ile ko derewa nora hetatu natu bali o hetatu matatu o mafelane Eagle FM the eye.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of failure.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You're the person who does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura menace.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura. And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before. Mm. It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past. Mm. And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Want to know about Namibia's latest business and economic news? Then look no further than the Villager newspaper. The Villager is an e-paper that is published every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for free, directly to your phone or computer. To become a subscriber, simply send a WhatsApp message with your number and email address to 081-200-4144. Be sure to save the phone number as a contact. The Villager, wherever you are.
Welcome back. Now we start off with news beyond the borders. And we're starting off in South Africa. We're starting off regionally. Now we're starting off with news so as to say that the government of Zambia is currently, or the former Zambian president's family is currently in court over his burial disputes. Let's take a listen to that.
That application for an interdict by Zambia's Attorney General against the Lungu family has now started. Let's listen in.
As it stands today, the family for the the family of the deceased, for the late president, doesn't want a piecemeal funeral situation. It's not really what he deserves. But saying that, we will give certain undertakings to the applicant that will take care of this application, and then we just need to talk and hash out time frames maybe for the main application that they will then have to serve. Maybe in that situation, we stand down or I speak to my learned senior friend for a few minutes.
Stand down.
As the court pleases, my lord. As the court pleases, thank you,
my lord. Patient.
All right, so it seems there's been just a short adjournment for lawyers of both sides to consult about, I suppose, the application and what's likely to happen next. But we'll keep a very close eye on the situation unfolding in the High Court in Pretoria. That's where the Zambian government, through the Attorney General, is taking Edgar Lungu's family to court over the burial of the former president, which is meant to get underway at 11 o'clock in Johannesburg.
Now, in other news, the foot and mouth disease outbreak on a more of an economical crisis.
Let's Former Zambian President Edgar Lungu is said to be laid to rest today in Hillbrow. That's it.
Inspections of livestock and strict biosafety measures have been intensified to counter the spread of the foot and mouth outbreak.
The auction houses are doing their utmost best to comply with the rules. And when the animals get off here, they are inspected on eye level for anything suspicious, and then they all go into the clamp there where you can see, and any suspicious animal will be put aside in that holding cage there at the back, because if we find one animal on a lorry that looks suspicious or on a trolley, we send them back. Not only one, we send the whole lot back.
Local subsistence farmers fear the worst.
This thing is thriving so fast whereby most farmers are even scared of selling or even moving their cattle.
Really painful because these farmers live off these animals and we too consume this meat and we can't buy meat that is infected.
While the much anticipated vaccines have arrived, they will not be administered across the board.
It's not desirable to have every animal in the province vaccinated. Vaccination is done for the purpose of reducing the viral load and it's done for the purpose of decreasing the spread of the virus. Our starting point is going to be cases that have been confirmed. So these are going to be the index farms, which involve feedlots. There's going to be different categories of vaccination. We're going to vaccinate for some categories, some facilities to slaughter. Some may decide to vaccinate, but for keeps.
Meanwhile, the Red Meat Producers Organization says the outbreak has far-reaching financial implications for farmers.
Currently, we are in weaning time. We need to sell our animals to feedlots. This is the time of the year where we usually generate our income, and now everything holds to a standstill. So the big issue is basically an economic crisis and not so much animal disease or animal health crisis. So let's say, for example, you're in the Northwest, even if you have received your vaccines and the animals was vaccinated and you can start to slaughter them, if there's no registered abattoir for F&B slaughters close to you, you can basically not market your animals.
Producers say the brunt of the outbreak will continue to be felt mostly by consumers as beef prices continue to skyrocket. Sintle Inglihihi, SABC News, Lichtenburg.
Meanwhile, in regards to the G20 share pass, the DG Zain Dagor opens the third meeting at the Sun City Resort in South Africa.
Let's take you to the story now. South Africa's Director General Zain Dagor is currently chairing the third meeting of the G20 Sherpas in Sun City. That's in the Northwest. This is a multi-day Sherpa meeting and it's gathered senior officials known as Sherpas from G20 countries to advance negotiations ahead of the main summit expected in November this year. Zain Dagor is currently at the podium. Let's listen in.
Practical solutions is going to be important. The unique experiences, knowledge, and perspectives brought by all of you are invaluable for a richer understanding of the problems and the development of comprehensive solutions to those problems. The meeting will also provide an opportunity for Sherpas to have a discussion on the global the geopolitical issues as part of the agenda. And I think, you know, we've always shied away from geopolitical issues, but given the events, not only of the last 2 years, but particularly of the last month, we're going to have some discussion on that in a measured but robust way. We do recognize, though, that the G20 is a forum for international economic cooperation, and we recognize that this should be the focus, but the ongoing conflicts worldwide, as we've pointed out before, are definitely now even more detrimental to not just peace and security, but economic development and the attainment of the Sustainable Development Goals. So we will discuss it, but we will also make sure it doesn't hold us back, but the discussion is important. So as agreed during the very first Sherpa meeting, there's a working method for managing the geopolitical issues. And just to remind all of us, the manner in which we will address this is that only the Sherpas, the ministers of foreign affairs, and then the leaders ultimately will engage on the geopolitical issues. We're following from the example set by Brazil. We want the working groups and the task teams to focus on the substantive issues they need to deal with without being held back by the geopolitical issues. So we will have to take the lead on this as the Sherpas, so we can guide the discussions that our foreign ministers will have, who in turn will also then, guide the leaders on the geopolitical issues. So we've got to take the responsibility on that. The working groups will focus on the technical issues, and we will get some report backs from them today on how that is going. We will, to some extent, provide some guidance to the working groups following this meeting on how to deal with the working groups on the geopolitical issues. We'll have a session later on our approach on the geopolitical issues, and we can go into a lot more detail on that. But suffice to say that it will be centered on the principles we've agreed on in India, the principles that we've agreed on in Brazil, which is centered on the UN Charter, respect for international law, and the fact that we must all be held equally accountable for this as we build a more peaceful world. So, colleagues, you will also recall that the presidency introduced the G20 at 20, a reflection on key achievements and the way forward initiative. This was a significant discussion point during the second Sherpa meeting that we held in April, where the G20 20 review roadmap was formally presented. The roadmap outlines a high-level qualitative assessment of the G20's progress against its key commitments and targets since its inception in 2008.
Welcome back. Now, today, the world stands and observes World Vitiligo Day, observed annually on June 2025. And it's a global awareness campaign focused on vitiligo, a skin condition characterized by the loss of skin pigmentation. This day aims to educate the public about vitiligo, to combat stigma, and provide support to those affected by it. Now, you might be wondering, what is vitiligo? Vitiligo is an autoimmune condition where melanocytes, the cells that produce melanin, that is the pigment that is responsible to give the skin its color, are destroyed. Now, where these melanocytes are destroyed, that the destruction leads to the development of white patches on the skin that sometimes look pinkish, but actually white. It affects approximately 1 to 2% of the global population, and vitiligo can affect people of all genders, ethnicities, and ages. But it's said to often appears between the ages of 20 and 30. Now, while it's not physically harmful, vitiligo can cause emotional distress and social stigma. Now, the aim on this particular day of June 2025 is to raise awareness whereby one can learn about it and its causes, its symptoms, and its treatments, as well as to combat stigma and also to challenge the misconceptions and the myths that come along with it, as well as to support individuals who are affected by it by showing sympathy and understanding those with vitiligo. Now, as well as to encourage research, now support efforts to find better treatments and potentially a cure for vitiligo, as well as to promote acceptance and help create a more inclusive society where people with vitiligo are celebrated for inner uniqueness according to the Society of Dermatology Nurse Practitioners.
Back then, I'd feel so offended if someone just came and just told me, you look like a cow, you look like a jazzy cow, because that's what they used to call me. When I was in class 2 is when I asked my mom, how comes I'm different? Why don't I look like my brothers? What are these white spots that I'm having? And then she told me, this is how God created you. It has been a journey of discovery each and every time with vitiligo.
I didn't want to be a teacher. I was to go for mass communication. But because you have people will advise you negatively, someone told me, now the way you are, who will watch you on screen?
Since it's not acquired, we don't have an absolute control in terms of how we can experience it. Because of the genetic predisposition, either you will see people from a particular family lineage, it can skip generation. Someone will tell them, you know, their grandfather or another person in their family, their uncles had it. And then it just comes to appear decades later. Yeah, so you can't prevent it. And there is no environmental susceptibility that makes you have the vitiligo.
I stopped taking medication. There is no need to spend on something that doesn't hurt, doesn't itch. It's just the skin color that is peeled. And I love it. Even I don't want to go back to being black.
So I started studying about vitiligo. And in the process, my self-healing came. I started now modeling, seeing the beautiful side of it, the patterns. So here it had formed the map of Kenya. But now it has spread. So I decided just to put this here, just to remember. This is the time I had a map of Africa here, and I had a map of Kenya here. I started looking at different dimensions. I actually do have a love heart here. I started looking at my patterns in that dimension and looking at it at the artistic side. People have come to a point that they are accepting that they are people like us. They are putting us in the runways. We are being seen as art. That wasn't happening before. We were those people who were hidden.
And there you had it from people with vitiligo. For some, they say vitiligo. Now, if you're somebody who's at home and perhaps...
We're showing you a split screen there because we're monitoring this specific stories from different...
If you're somebody who's at home and you do notice symptoms of vitiligo, don't be afraid to reach out and to know that you are beautiful and unique. I do like one of the speakers just said that he stopped taking his medication because there's no need for him to take medication for something that doesn't itch and doesn't hurt. Now, I don't know perhaps what actually the purpose of that medication was for him specifically. But as for you who is at home, do make sure that you do seek out whether it's the emotional, psychological or physical help that you need so that you can know that whatever choice that you're doing is actually one that is safe for you. Now let's move over to Burkina Faso villages as they plant thousands of trees in Climate Drive.
Hundreds took part in this year's tree planting festival in the remote village of Guiba in central Burkina Faso. This Saturday initiative, dubbed Patriotic Hour to Green Faso, saw more than 4,600 medicinal and fruit trees planted. The nation's prime minister set the tone by planting a Kaya senegalensis tree, which is widely used in traditional medicine.
Most of the time in our villages, even in our towns, when things are not going well, many people put more trust in trees than in modern medicine. And the two are now being combined because the direction given by the Ministry of Health is to ensure greater integration of traditional medicine within our hospitals.
Officials say the drive is vital for the West African country that is facing desertification and climate-related challenges. They hope the greening campaign will help restore degraded land, improve livelihoods, and mitigate the impacts of climate change. In the long term, the government also hopes to establish groves with medicinal plants in each of the nation's provinces.
In order to consolidate the achievements of previous editions, a number of innovative initiatives have been introduced. These include a medicinal plant grove, a school botanical garden, a patriotic hour to Green Faso, a commune and a department with 2 kilometers of planting. With these actions, the 2025 reforestation campaign is positioning itself as an essential lever for inclusive green growth.
Since coming to power, the nation's charismatic leader, Captain Ibrahim Traore, who also took part in the exercise, has promoted the fusion of modern and traditional medicine. He champions medicinal plants as a source of health and climate resilience for communities. David Mbidi, CGTN.
We're showing you a split screen there because we're monitoring this.
Demonstrators return to Kenya on anniversary of 2024 protests.
Wednesday morning, Kenyan protesters began to pour out into the streets of the capital, Nairobi. Police officers in anti-riot gear restricted vehicular traffic along most roads leading to Nairobi's central business district. Some motorists were turned back, but a number of protesters made their way to the city center on foot. There, the swelling numbers assembled to raise their voices against a number of grievances. The protests come on the first anniversary of 2024's anti-tax protests, which culminated in the storming of the country's parliament and saw several deaths as police opened fire on demonstrators. A year later, the death of a teacher and blogger in police custody triggered a fresh wave of demonstrations. On the eve of the protests, the embassies of 12 Western nations released a joint statement urging Kenyan authorities to facilitate peaceful demonstrations and to refrain from violence. Interior Cabinet Secretary Kipchumba Murkomen asserted that the government would endeavor to protect everyone and their livelihoods. However, as the protests progressed, police officers deployed the use of tear gas to disperse the crowds. The protesters plan to hold memorials in honor of those who were killed in the 2024 protests. Demonstrations are also ongoing in other towns across Kenya. Bukis Anyabwa, CGTN.
CGTN's Daniel Arap-Moi is covering those protests for us here in Nairobi. Daniel Arap-Moi, thank you for joining us here on Africa Live. Daniel, protesters had started gathering very early in and around Nairobi CBD. What's the latest on this youth-led protest?
Well, yes, Richard, we've been here since morning. It's past 1 o'clock. We're still here in the central business district of Nairobi, where protesters, you know, since morning, there's been clashes between the police and the protesters who are, some are pelting stones at the anti-riot police, and the police are trying to block them from accessing the central business district. So it's been running battles really since morning up until now, but security is very tight. Right now where we are, the protesters have moved from across Moi Avenue to Kenyatta Avenue. They are trying to access Parliament, but the anti-riot police is not making it happen at all. They've blocked them. There's a lot of tear gas, as you can just hear right behind me. They're still, firing tear gas. Since morning up to now, there's been constant tear gas. And I don't know how this is going to last, because we are getting information that there's another large group that is coming from Thika Road. They're also trying to access the central business district. But with what we are seeing, it's going to take quite some time. But we don't know how long this is going to hold. But for now, since morning, it is running battles with the police and tear gas, really, Richard.
Well, Daniel, let's talk more about the security measures. What security measures can you highlight and illuminate for us that have been put in place specifically to protect lives and property, including critical government installations?
Well, Richard, what we are seeing around the Central Business District is a really heavy deployment by all the security agencies. There are those in plain clothes, there are those in uniform. They are all trying to ensure that people do not enter into the CBD and loot people's shops, which most of them are actually closed. We've not seen any business that is open around downtown here. Security is all over. They're trying to patrol those areas that the protesters have not yet reached. So no one is accessing key installation. Where we are is the Supreme Court. We are seeing a lot of security officials deployed here to ensure that no one has access to the parliament. Parliament is just across the road. So there's heavy deployment in many of the big installation. I mean, we are talking about
rising gold prices push West African mines to boost security to curb illegal mining.
Surging gold prices have meant that gold miners in West Africa must now spend more to protect the precious commodity. There has been a surge in illegal mining operations made worse by high unemployment in the region. David Mbithi now looks at the situation in Ghana.
The new way to monitor illegal gold mining in Ghana, a surveillance drone. This one operated by Goldfields Mine staff across the expansive Takwa gold mine in the southwestern part of the country.
The drone is a faster way and it has a faster coverage. So you could use a few minutes to fly a drone over the whole concession. But if you would want to go physically, that would mean the use of fuel and human resource and going around all the mine. So the drones and tech has been very helpful in fighting crime on the mine.
The reason why surveillance must be deployed on air and on the ground, the rising price of gold, now sitting above $3,000 per ounce, has meant the reward outweighs the risk for a lot of these illegal miners, and sometimes confrontations with law enforcement ensues.
Illegal mining, now it has become a national issue. Yeah, so it's not peculiar to go for Takwa mine alone. It's a broader conversation out there. For us here, it is an issue to us as discreet department and as a mine, but in our own way, we have our own ways of trying to handle the these illegal mining issues. But it's a security concern to both the mine and the security department as well. So we try as much to have 24-hour surveillance on our concessions and all the illegal.
In West Africa, 3 to 5 million people depend on unregulated mining, accounting for approximately 30% of its gold production. Known in Ghana as Galamsey, it serves as an economic lifeline in areas with limited formal employment opportunities.
Can you? In the olden days, or let's say in years past, where there wasn't any aerial view or any AI, you just go by word of mouth. You get people to tell you, oh, there's illegal mining happening here, and before the task force get there, there's no one there. So with this, we're able to get precision, like point blank, the location and the precise location of all these illegalities.
Ghana's major corporate miners have intensified their campaign for military protection at mining sites this year. According to two mining executives who are part of negotiations, Ghanaian authorities want miners to cover deployment costs estimated at $18,000 daily for a contingent of under 50 personnel.
Meanwhile, Middle East and North Africa have been ranked as the least peaceful region.
Global stability has fallen sharply over the past decade, marked by a surge in political instability, an increase in conflicts and rising geopolitical tensions. In particular, the Middle East and North Africa region and sub-Saharan Africa are heavily impacted by security crises and conflict. CGTN's Robert Nagila breaks down the latest data from the Global Peace Index.
2024 saw a huge surge in global conflict, the most recorded in a single year since the end of World War II, according to the Global Peace Index Report 2025. The report says there were 59 active state-based conflicts in 2024, with 78 countries engaged in conflict beyond their borders. Russia is ranked the least peaceful country in the world, while Iceland is ranked the most peaceful. The report estimates the global death toll at over 63,000, but adds it could be much higher. The report ranks the Middle East and North Africa as the least peaceful region in the world. This is mainly due to the Israel-Gaza conflict, which has had a huge impact on regional stability. The report ranks Sudan as the least peaceful country in the region. This is as a result of fighting between the Sudanese armed forces and the paramilitary rapid support forces, which broke out in April 2023. At least 6,800 deaths were recorded in 2024 alone. In sub-Saharan Africa, the Democratic Republic of Congo is ranked the least peaceful country in the region. The government is battling the M23 rebels, who the UN says are backed by Rwanda. The UN estimates there are between 3,000 to 4,000 Rwandan troops currently operating in the DRC. Meanwhile, the report ranks Mauritius the most peaceful country in the region. It has not been involved in any internal or external conflict over the past 6 years. And Uganda recorded the largest improvement in peacefulness. Robert Nagila, CGTN.
We're showing you a split screen there because we're monitoring.
President Donald Trump insists that Iran's nuclear sites obliterated despite intelligence report.
President Trump has insisted that Iran's nuclear sites were completely destroyed in the U.S. strikes on Iran. His comments came after a leaked U.S. intelligence assessment concluded that Iran's nuclear program had been set back by just a few months in the attacks. Details of the initial damage assessment were leaked to the BBC's U.S. partner CBS and other media. The briefing was originally reported by CNN. Its preliminary finding is that Iran's stockpile of enriched uranium was not destroyed, and its centrifuges used to enrich the nuclear fuel are largely intact. CNN quoted one official as saying the U.S. set them back maybe a few months tops. Well, President Trump hit out at what he called the fake news, posting on his Truth Social account. He said the reports were an attempt to demean one of the most successful military strikes in history, and the nuclear sites in Iran are completely destroyed. At a meeting of the UN Security Council, Israel's ambassador, Danny Danon, was asked about the damage done by the strikes. Here's what he had to say.
Well, I think it's still early to assess all the strikes. We know we were able to push back the program. We were able to remove the imminent threat that we had.
Well, Brad Sherman is a Democrat congressman from California and a member of the U.S. House Foreign Affairs Committee. He told us Iran appears to have a nuclear stockpile still in hand.
The fact is that there were photographs of trucks going to Fordo the day or two before the raid. Presumably, they moved the stockpile out. And nothing from the Trump administration says they got the stockpile. The stockpile's enough for roughly 9 nuclear weapons. Now, if they destroyed the centrifuges, that diminishes the ability of Iran to create the 10th, 11th, or 12th nuclear weapon. But when you just say the program, well, what does that mean? Does it mean the stockpiles? Does that mean the weaponization capacity? Does that mean the centrifuges? Using vague terms is what you do when you can't make a strong case using specific terms.
Well, our correspondent in Washington, John Donison, has more on what the initial reports of what the intelligence assessment said.
Well, several U.S. intelligence officials have spoken to, first of all, to CNN and also the New York Times, but also to other American media. And what these intelligence officials have said is that a preliminary report into the extent of the damage to Iran's nuclear facilities from those attacks over the weekend by the United States show that while those facilities have been damaged, the nuclear program has not been significantly set back. They estimate it's been set back by up to 3 months. Now, before the attack, American intelligence thought that at a push, Iran could build a nuclear weapon within maybe 3 months. So they say they pushed that back to 6 months. But although there seems to be extensive damage, according to this report, to the exterior of, in particular, the Fordo nuclear facility, that huge facility buried deep underneath the mountain, they say that the centrifuges deep down under the mountain, although damaged, have not been destroyed. And crucially, the 500 or so kilos of enriched uranium, which is what Iran would need to build a weapon, well, that had been shifted out from the site before the attack happened. Now, it should be said that...
And now this has brought us to the conclusion after this episode of On the Radar Analysis. Now, with that being said, we say goodbye and make room for the Onkona Nathenge program brought to you by David Shombe. From Indafa, happy Juju, it is goodbye and have yourself a wonderful day ahead.
Want to know about Namibia's latest business and economic news? Then look no further than the Villager newspaper. The Villager is an e-paper that is published every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for free, directly to your phone or computer. To become a subscriber, simply send a WhatsApp message with your number and email address to 081-200-4144. Be sure to save the phone number as a contact. The Villager, wherever you are.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I am planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
Great news! Impact just got even better. We have added brand new features to make your experience smoother, faster, and more powerful than ever before. Ready to unlock the full potential of IMBA? Get all exclusive features for just $36 Namibian a month, or save even more with our special subscription plans. 5% discount for 3 months subscription, 10% discount for 6 months subscription, and 25% discount for 12 months subscription. Choose the plan that works best for you and start enjoying everything IMBA has to offer at an unbeatable price. IMBA, where the world congregates. Download it and subscribe today.
Get social with us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Our handle is Eagle FM Namibia.
Eagle FM, the eye. The eye.
Ipurane ngelo wapumbwa Eva tere ulikoni maundu tuto ingida ashike kapeno nwe utete okoye ekukurile oshafa fana nongeshefa ili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshiwala ono ngeshefa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi toda njuka okukwetira oipindi konu konda doi nawa nune udo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshefa omarudi kayo loka opone ushendife nawa nokumona oijabo ili nawa Ninge pata fanona, Monica ko Eagle FM, onora etatuimwe mbali heali, nola natu, heali bali no heali. Ileko berewa, nora etatu natu, bali o etatu watatu, o mafilane, Eagle FM, the eye.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually... to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura, and I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before. Mm. It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something Namibia will not be able to achieve.